get lost in you. So anyone who finds me first finds you. I want to be one with you. Where I am, you begin and keep on going.
Hi friends, this is Dr. Mike Spaulding, and you are listening to the Transforming Word radio program. Thank you for joining me today for our study through the Scriptures. If you're ready to dig deep and learn what the Bible has to say about being a disciple of the Lord Jesus Christ, then stay tuned for today's teaching. May the Word of God transform your heart. What this alerts us to, brothers and sisters, and the reason why I point this out, is the fact that Jesus spoke prophetically of events that his disciples would live, see, and experience, as well as events that they would not. And that's a feature, by the way, of all of the Old Testament prophets. Jesus was speaking in that great tradition of the Old Testament prophets who predicted future events in terms of the events that the hearers would both experience and their progeny would experience. The Apostle Peter understood this when he chided scoffers. If you understand Peter's statement, note taker 2 Peter 3:3-4 says this: "Know this first of all, that in the last days," now I've already told you we're living in the last days. Peter said, "In the last days, mockers will come with their mocking," and then he gives us their motivation, "after their own lusts, saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation." You tell us Jesus is coming again, it's been 2,000 years. I don't think it's going to happen. That illustrates the primary tool of Satan. What is Satan's primary tool? Deception. Deception. 1 Corinthians 11:3 says this, note takers: "But I am afraid that as the serpent," the nakash in the Hebrew, "deceived Eve by his craftiness, your minds will be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ." 2 Corinthians 11:3. "I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your minds will be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ." How did Satan deceive Eve? That's the question. How did he do that? By casting doubt upon the character of God. By creating doubt in her mind. And he said this: "Indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden?" Well, first of all, he didn't say that. He said, just this one. Everything else is for you. Let me paraphrase that. Eve said, "Nah, we can eat from any except one. And if we eat," and you know what she did, right? She added two. "If we eat or touch this one, we're going to die." And man, Satan was Johnny on the spot. He picked right up on that and he said, "You shall surely not die." What did he just say? God's lying to you. God told you that because if you eat, and this is a paraphrase, God told you that because if you eat from that tree, you're going to be just like him, and he doesn't want you to be just like him, knowing good and evil. You remember what happened next. Genesis 3:6, Adam and Eve looked at that tree in a whole different light. When the devil got in there and cast a doubt, all of a sudden they started rethinking what they knew. And they looked at that tree again. Here's what it says, Genesis 3, 6 through 8. Notice these three things. Maybe I'll tie this in a future teaching to 1 John 2. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, now that's the beginning of it. Don't eat from this tree. Now she's changing her mind. Wait a minute, this looks just as good as any other tree in the garden. Why can't we eat this one? It was good for food. So she's already hurled over God's prohibition. Don't. And that it was a delight for the eyes. Well, that's the most beautiful fruit in the whole garden. Why would he restrict that from us? And that the tree was desirable to make one wise. Where did she get that idea? Satan. God didn't tell her any of that. He said, just don't eat it, because the day that you do, you're going to die. And Satan said, no. God told you that because he doesn't want you to be like him, knowing good and evil. And Eve translated that to, God doesn't want us to be wise like he is. Now, I bring this up and use that as the springboard, because Jesus' first instruction to the disciples then and to us today is to watch out for deception. Watch out for deception. Look at verse 5. Mark 13, verse 5. Jesus began to say to them, see to it that no one misleads you. Watch out for deception. People are going to try to mislead you. And in this context, they're going to mislead you from God's truth. And what is the number one truth that people are misled about today? Think about this, folks. The number one truth that people are misled about today. Here it is. You ready? Who is Jesus? Who is Jesus? Verse 6. Many will come in my name saying, I am he, and will mislead many. So Jesus says, watch out for deception, and here's the number one deception that you're going to see. Who am I? Who am I? Who is Jesus? Now, there have been many people over the years that have claimed to be Jesus, you know, some type of Messiah figure. They don't have to say, yes, I'm the Christ. They can pass themselves off. We call them cults, by the way. They can pass themselves off as some kind of Messiah figure, and they've all been proven to be fakes and liars. But the most dangerous deception concerning Jesus today, the most dangerous deception, and we're seeing the rotten fruit of this deception in the church today. You ready? The most dangerous deception concerning Jesus and a false Jesus is Islam. It's Islam. I sent an article to many of you yesterday on this very topic. It's posted all over the internet today on a number of different platforms. If you didn't get it and you want it, then let me know and I'll send it to you. But here's a sampling of the depth of the deception when we're talking about Islam. Here is a book, and I don't really need to read many of these quotes because you've heard them. This is House of War. House of War, Islam's Jihad Against the World. G.M. Davis is the author. How many of you notice that today's politicians fall all over themselves trying to excuse Islam? Daily. Daily. Murderous and barbarous acts by Islamists are excused today, repeatedly. Our politicians, I tell you what, the turning point for me for George Bush. Was when he said, Islam is a religion of peace. That told me right there he had been co-opted into the New World Order. Because only a fool would make that statement. But we've had plenty over the years. Bill Clinton, when he was the president, no religion condones the murder of innocent men, women, and children. But our actions were aimed at fanatics and killers who wrap murder in the cloak of righteousness and doing so profane the great religion in whose name they claim to act. He's talking about Islam. Islam doesn't teach that. Folks, Islam does teach that. The murder of innocent men, women, and children. Hillary Clinton. We honor the universal values that are embodied in Islam, love of family and community, mutual respect, the power of education. Let me tell you something. Muslims are some of the most ignorant people on the face of the earth. I can't believe you just said that. Here's why I say that. They train their children from the time they're able to walk to dress up like jihadists, carry around little plastic weapons, and pretend to murder Jews and Christians. Don't tell me they're not the most ignorant people on the face of the earth. Please don't tell me they're the religion of peace. We are under a great deception in the world today. I've got other quotes, but I'm going to move on. You get the point. Kathy, do you have the PragerU video up? I want you to watch this. It's 4 or 5 minutes, and then I'll come back to the teaching. PragerU, this lady is brilliant. Brilliant. Let's watch that.
I was a practicing Muslim and remained one for almost half my life. I attended madrasas, that is Islamic schools, and memorized large parts of the Quran. As a child, I lived in Mecca for a time and frequently visited the Grand Mosque. As a teenager, I sympathized with the Muslim Brotherhood. At 22, while my family was living in Kenya, my father arranged my marriage to a member of our family clan, a man that I had never met. I ran away, made my way to Holland, studied there, and eventually was elected a member of the Dutch Parliament. Now I live in the United States. In short, I have seen Islam from the inside and the outside. I believe that a reform of Islam is necessary and possible, and only Muslims can make that reform a reality. But we in the West cannot remain on the sidelines as though the outcome of this struggle has nothing to do with us. If the jihadists win and the hope for a reformed Islam dies, the rest of the world will pay a terrible price. The terror attacks in New York, London, Madrid, Paris, and many other places are only a preview for what's to come. For this reason, I believe that it's foolish to insist, as Western leaders habitually do, that the violent acts committed in the name of Islam can somehow be divorced from the religion itself. For more than a decade, my message has been simple. Islam is not a religion of peace. When I assert this, I do not mean that Islamic belief makes all Muslims violent. This is manifestly not the case. There are many millions of peaceful Muslims in the world. What I do say is that the call to violence and the justification for it are explicitly stated in the sacred texts of Islam. Moreover, this theologically sanctioned violence is there to be activated by any number of offenses, including, but not limited to, adultery, blasphemy, homosexuality, and apostasy, that is to leave Islam. Those who tolerate this intolerance do so at their peril. As someone who has known what it is to live without freedom, I watch in amazement as those who call themselves liberals and progressives, people who claim to believe so fervently in individual liberty and minority rights, make common cause with the forces in the world that manifestly pose the greatest threat to that very freedom and those very minorities. In 2014, I was invited to accept an honorary degree from Brandeis University for the work I have done on behalf of women's rights in the Muslim world. That invitation was withdrawn after professors and students protested my criticism of Islam. My subsequent disinvitation, as it came to be called, was no favor to Muslims, just the opposite. By labeling critical examination of Islam as inherently racist, we make the chances of reformation far less likely. There are no limits on criticism of Christianity at American universities or anywhere else for that matter. Why should there be of Islam? Instead of contorting Western intellectual traditions so as not to offend our Muslim fellow citizens, we need to defend both those traditions and the Muslim dissidents who take great risks to promote them. We should support these brave men and women in every way possible. Imagine a platform for Muslim dissidents that communicated their message through YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. These are the Muslims we should be supporting for our sake as much as for the sake of Islam. In the Cold War, the West celebrated dissidents such as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Andrei Sakharov, and Vaclav Havel, who had the courage to challenge the Soviet system from within. Today, there are many dissidents who challenge Islam, but the West either ignores them or dismisses them as not representative. This is a grave mistake. Reformers such as Tawfiq Hamid, Asra Nomani, and Zuhi Jasser, and many others must be supported and protected. They should be as well known as Solzhenitsyn, Sakharov, and Havel were in the 1980s. If we do in fact support political, social, and religious freedom, then we cannot in good conscience give Islam a free pass on the grounds of multicultural sensitivity. We need to say to Muslims living in the West, if you want to live in our societies, to share in the material benefits, then you need to accept that our freedoms are not optional. Islam is at a crossroads of reformation or self-destruction. But so is the West. I'm Ayan Hirsi Ali of Harvard University for Prager University.
She says it exactly the way that it needs to be said, folks. Satan, who is known as Allah in Islam, that's who Allah is Satan, has constructed a masterful deception, and he's named it Islam. Christians of all people should know better than to believe the lies of Islam, but unfortunately that is not the case. And this is to their shame and possibly even their destruction and ours. Please note that Mark 13, 22 and 23, notice those verses where Jesus says that the deception is going to be so pervasive that if it were possible, and the grammar says that it is not, but if it were possible, even the elect would fall victim. Mark 13, 22, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show signs and wonders in order to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But take heed, behold, I have told you everything in advance. Multiculturalism and both secular and religious pluralism have turned Christian minds to mush. And I can't say it any clearer than that. Multiculturalism, diversity, as it is being used by the enemies of Jesus Christ, has turned Christian minds into some kind of intellectual zombie. Dead men and women walking without an ability to think. Evangelism, in fact, has become, in my view, to the Muslim apostate. There are many examples of this. I don't want to get ahead of myself. How does Islam, here's the question maybe you're asking, how does Islam present the most clear and present danger to Christians in this context of Mark chapter 13, when Jesus says the greatest deception that is coming is, who is Jesus? Who is Jesus? Would it surprise you if I told you that Islam has an eschatology? Islam has a theology of the end days. Would it surprise you if I told you that Jesus plays a significant role in Islamic eschatology. He does. Jesus plays a very prominent role in Islamic eschatology. But when I say Jesus in that context, I'm talking about the Islamic Jesus, not the biblical Jesus, not the true Jesus, not the Jesus of the scriptures, the Jesus of the satanic system called Islam, that Jesus. Let me unpack this. And I've made this statement numerous times over the years. Islam does say that Jesus is a great prophet. He's a great prophet. But, he's at least third in the pecking order. At least third. Because you have what they call the 12th Imam, or the Mahdi, and I'll speak to that in a moment. And then you have Muhammad. And then you have Jesus. The Islamic Jesus is a great prophet, but he's not the Son of God. The Islamic Jesus is a great prophet, but he wasn't born of a virgin. The Islamic Jesus is a great prophet, but he didn't lead a sinless life. He wasn't crucified. He didn't die. In fact, Islam teaches that Jesus was translated just like Elijah and Muhammad, and he went to be with Allah. Jesus was a great prophet, but because he didn't die, there was no resurrection. The Islamic Jesus is now standing alongside Allah, waiting to return. When Allah gives him the go-ahead, Jesus is going to return. Now, some silly Christians, and I was being kind there, some Christians get all excited about that. Oh, yes, we believe Jesus is going to return too. Muslims believe Jesus is going to return. We've got something in common. Guess what? No, we don't. No, we don't. Or as Lee Corso used to say, not so fast, my friends. I would recommend this book to anyone that wants to understand this in more detail than I'm going to give you today. It's Joel Richardson's book, The Islamic Antichrist. The Islamic Antichrist. Let me read just a section of this, and I'll try to make it fast because we've got a lot left to cover. The return of the Muslim Jesus. According to Islam's sacred traditions, Jesus' return is usually described as taking place just outside Damascus. He is a subordinate of the Mahdi, and I'm summarizing because it's like 8 pages, so I'm sure you don't want me to read this. Or maybe you do. The Islamic Jesus is a subordinate of the Mahdi, or the 12th Imam. And I'll, again, tell you who that is in a moment. Jesus descends to meet the army of the Mahdi, who's already come back, and is preparing for battle. Now, the Mahdi is going to lead this army against, ready? The Jews and the Christians. The Jews and the Christians. Wait a minute, Jesus can't fight against the Christians. Oh, yes, he can, you see, because in Islamic theology, Jesus is a Muslim. He's a radical Muslim. Richardson says, after Jesus returns, in keeping with his identity as a faithful Muslim, he will perform the ritual pilgrimage to Mecca called the Hajj. Jesus will institute Islamic law. We in the West know it as Sharia. While the Mahdi, as the caliph of the Muslims, is superior to Jesus in Islam, Jesus remains a leader of the Muslim community. According to the Islamic tradition, Jesus' primary purpose will be to oversee the institution and the enforcement of Islamic Sharia law over all the earth. What's the implication? Jesus in Islam will abolish Christianity. Jesus will make it a mission to destroy, pull down every cross on every church steeple or on the side of a church building. Every cross will be destroyed when the Islamic Jesus comes back. So, the return of the Islamic Jesus, in case you haven't figured it out yet, is the exact opposite picture of the true biblical Jesus. In fact, the Islamic Jesus is a near exact picture, and I just skimmed. The Islamic Jesus is a near exact picture of the biblical false prophet. To those out there that are listening to this on the radio, you still think we've got something to dialogue with Muslims about to try and find common ground?
I want to get lost in you, so anyone who finds me first finds you.
That's all we have time for today on the Transforming Word radio program. Thank you for listening. My prayer is that you are encouraged as you study the Bible for yourselves. The Transforming Word radio program is an outreach ministry of the Transforming Word Ministries. You may contact me at the following email address, drmichaelspalding@gmail.com. Again, drmichaelspalding@gmail.com. For more information about the Transforming Word Ministries or to support this ministry with your financial gifts, please write to Dr. Mike Spaulding, P.O. Box 3007, Lima, Ohio 45807. Again, Dr. Mike Spaulding, P.O. Box 3007, Lima, Ohio 45807. When you write, please include the call letters of this station. May God richly bless you today as you seek Him.